Senate Resource Committee, please come to order. Today we have our briefing on the Alaska land situation. John Katz, who was a special counsel to the governor during all the D2 and Alaska lands negotiation. Welcome, John. We're very glad to have you here. And would you introduce any of the others working with you? And just, this is very informal briefing, so we'll just listen to you. And if you want questions after, fine. Or in between, fine. Which way would you like it?
I think if it's all right with you, I'd prefer them after, because I think I will cover in the second half of my presentation what might be some of the questions.
Fine. So then with Mr. Katz, you're on.
To my left is Tom Meacham from the Attorney General's Office. Tom provided a lot of the legal advice that we used during the last 2 years in Washington. To my right is Jim Wicks from the Department of Natural Resources, and Jim has coordinated the resource input for the last year from all state agencies. With your indulgence, Madam Chairman, I'd like to divide the presentation into two parts. The first is a brief analysis of the bill in relationship to the legislature's 7 consensus points, and the second will be a discussion of the early phases of implementation and what the executive branch is doing with respect to the bill now. Let me start the discussion of the consensus points by offering a couple of disclaimers. Any discussion is necessarily subjective and will reflect some of my own views, I guess. But I do think that it's helpful to do it, and it is helpful in a relative sense to compare the bill to other versions of the bill and other possible options. Also, one thing that the consensus points do not do is factor in the consideration of whether we could have done better in this Congress than we were able to do in the last Congress. And as all of you know, that was a very vitriolic debate, and I don't want to reopen it here, except to make a couple of observations about the factors that existed at that time, at least. One is that it is by no means clear that the state could have stopped legislation even if we had wanted to, and at some junctures in the process we did in fact try. It is clear that we could not have stopped legislation in the House of Representatives, which was controlled by Congressman Udall and the House leadership. In the Senate, the issue is a little bit more problematic, and it involves a debate between our two senators and something that I don't think I want to get into again. But I think it is true to say that the Congress was exhausted with this issue. They'd spent more time on it, as I understand it, than almost any bill since the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And there was a real impetus for legislation, even among some of the people that supported our views from a substantive point of view. Another factor that at least I think is worth considering is that there is no question that the Carter administration in its waning days would have withdrawn many millions of acres more of national monuments and wildlife refuges and probably other withdrawals. And at the very least, that would have significantly upped the ante in terms of finding a solution that we could have lived with. While the environmentalists don't have the clout in this Congress that they had in the last Congress, they do have the capacity, particularly in the House of Representatives, to continue to block legislation. And at least one concern I had was leaving those executive withdrawals on the books for a long period of time, permitting them, therefore, to obtain some credibility that they didn't have initially, and then wondering if, in fact, the situation would improve enough in the future to obtain the enactment of a better bill. The third factor worth considering is that even though the Congress is significantly more conservative than it was before, that conservatism does not always translate itself in terms of a more favorable position on conservation issues. And there are at least, for example, some Republicans who were elected whose views on conservation were at least as strong or perhaps stronger than the Democrats they replaced. With that, I think I'd like to go on to the specifics of the consensus points. It's my judgment that the state got about 80% of what it wanted in terms of the consensus points, just looking at the merits and not looking at the political and policy considerations that I just mentioned. Some people have said, well, if how could we get 80% if the environmentalists alleged that they also got 80%? And I think the answer is that at least some of the issues that we were concerned about were not of any particular concern to the environmentalists and vice versa. So it was possible for us to foster and promote our position before the Congress on some issues and not incur really adamant opposition from other groups in the process. In terms of the specific consensus points, the first one is the revocation of the executive withdrawals that were made in 78 and thereafter. The bill contained a mechanism for accomplishing that. In fact, that mechanism has been activated, and the monuments and with wildlife refuges and other withdrawals no longer exist, the ones that were created by executive action. They've been replaced by the legislative boundaries, and while all of us have some problems with those boundaries, in a number of instances that were of great concern to the state, they do reflect a more surgical view of the issue than were the all-encompassing boundaries created by the Carter administration. The second consensus point is the so-called No More Clause. That is a provision which precludes executive action in the future in the absence of congressional concurrence. That clause does exist in the bill. It provides that with respect to conservation withdrawals above 5,000 acres, the Congress must affirmatively act to approve those withdrawals within 1 year of their creation. And while I think we will fare far better in the current administration than we did in the past, I think that particular clause may well inure to our benefit sometime in the future. The third consensus point related to the conveyance of state and native lands under the bill. This was extremely important to all of us because the net result of good conveyance provisions was to ensure that no matter what occurred on the federal lands, at least about 150 million acres would be in non-federal ownership, either in state ownership or in private ownership in Alaska. And we were able to include just about the version of the conveyance title that we wanted in the bill. The state portion of that title is really divided into two principal parts. The first is a legislative conveyance of all right, title, and interest of the federal government in certain described lands and a confirmation of prior state selections and tentative approvals. The net result of that is to confirm and convey about 98 million acres of the state's entitlement. Now that section is not a panacea because the federal government is not thereby conveying clear title. It is still imperative that the Bureau of Land Management go through the adjudication process to assure the state of clear title. But the provisions do change the burden of proof, in my opinion. The areas involved become state lands. They're no longer federal lands. In some instances, there at least is the possibility of limited development using some mechanisms that I won't talk about here. And I think that we are in an infinitely better position vis-a-vis the federal government, but we do have to take the next step and make sure that the Bureau of Land Management has the monetary resources and manpower to assure compliance with the promise that Congress made. The second portion of the conveyance title affects a number of beneficial changes in the land-related provisions of the Statehood Act. Just to mention a few, it extends for 10 years the period in which the state can make selections. Under the Statehood Act, we were compelled to make them within 25 years. Now we have 35 years. It also significantly liberalizes the selection rules that apply to the state so that we can make selections in roughly the same configuration as the native corporations could. It allows us in virtually all instances to preempt federal withdrawals other than conservation system withdrawals and military withdrawals. So, in other words, Bureau of Land Management withdrawals and classifications will no longer be a barrier as they once were to state selections. On the private conveyance side of the issue, the bill does perfect certain native selection rights and effectuates a number of land exchanges. But it does not, contrary to some of the information I've seen in the papers, increase the native's total entitlement under the Act. It merely assures that the at least in my view, that the Congress, that the promise that Congress originally made can be complied with, and there were a number of barriers in certain instances that would have perhaps precluded that. The bill also would convey by legislative action most native allotments, with some exceptions, and all the pending applications made under other public land laws, such as the homestead laws, homesite laws, etc. Again, with certain opportunities for objection. The next consensus point relates to transportation across federal lands to state and private lands. This is perhaps the most misunderstood aspect of the bill, at least in my experience. I find it helpful to divide that issue into three principal parts. The first concerns access to inholdings, state and private lands located within conservation system units. There is an absolute guarantee of economically feasible access subject to reasonable regulation. Now, of course, reasonable regulation in one person's eyes may not be reasonable in another, and we have to keep track of that, but at least there's some case law on what reasonable regulations are. And the important aspect, I think, is that that there is that absolute guarantee. The second issue concerns access for traditional means such as airplanes, snow machines, and motorboats. Again, there is an absolute guarantee of access subject to reasonable regulation, and there is also a process which would permit the Secretary of the Interior, after going through a hearing process, to close lands if he makes certain findings about the detrimental impacts. But for the first time, at least, we have a precedent where motorized vehicular use will be permitted on a generalized basis in parks and in wilderness areas. The third transportation issue is the one that is really most difficult to get into and relates to major transportation corridors across our major transportation functions across federal lands, such as for pipelines, highways, major transmission lines. There's no question in my view that the version in the final bill is convoluted and complex and arduous to pursue. All I can say about it, though, is that by all accounts it is a significant improvement over existing law. And frankly, we deserve that improvement because, or an even greater improvement because of the size of the conservation system withdrawals in Alaska merits, I think, very special treatment. But that provision does reduce from about 7 years in the usual situation to about a year and 4 months the decision-making process within the federal government. It assures far better coordination among federal agencies. It injects economic criteria into the decision-making process. It provides sort of an accelerated process for considering transportation decisions where there is no applicable law, rather than just going through the usual committee process in Congress. So I think, therefore, that it's a good starting point, and my feeling about it is that it's so complex that all we can do is seek to implement it and see where the glitches are and then go back to Congress and ask for remedial legislation. But I do think it's important to note that this process ought not to apply to people, to state or private inholders within conservation system units. They ought to be able to avail themselves of the more mandatory approach that I described earlier. The fourth element to mention is that in a couple of key junctures, most notably access across the boot of the Gates of the Arctic into the Ambler Mining District, there is a guaranteed corridor within the bill. And of course, we would have preferred that more corridors, transportation corridors, be identified by Congress, but we did the best we could in that situation. The next consensus point relates to the continuation of traditional state management over fish and resident wildlife. There is a very strong affirmative statement in the bill relating to continuation of traditional state management. Beyond that, we were able to rectify, I think, every one of the specific management concerns that were identified by Representatives Halford and Miles last year. They were concerned, in general terms, about a confusion between the role of the federal government as habitat manager and the role of the state as the actual manager of the species, and I shared that concern, as did my colleagues. So we proposed a number of so-called cut-and-bite amendments that were added to the bill. The one area of conflict, or possible conflict, that I prefer to get into a little later in this presentation relates to the subsistence title. The disclaimer clause that I mentioned earlier says that except as may be provided in the subsistence title, traditional state management is confirmed. It does not make a judgment that even in the subsistence title, traditional state management has been abrogated. In the normal course of events, the state will continue to manage fish and resident wildlife within conservation system units and on federal lands, but as I'll discuss later, if the state fails to acknowledge three specific federal policies, then the federal government, following a process in the bill, can step in. In that one instance, which is a very important instance, then the federal government would transcend its traditional role with respect to habitat management. The next consensus point relates to the maintenance of the traditional Alaska lifestyle. For me, that's translated into a couple of principal concerns. The first is to try to avoid the imposition on Alaskans of a so-called permit lifestyle. That is, all the impacts created by additional federal paperwork, additional federal oversight, and more contact with the federal government than a lot of residents of rural Alaska want. There's no way to guarantee that that will not occur. In fact, there will be additional federal involvement as much as we've all fought to oppose it. But we were able to obtain a number of specific statutory guarantees that related to issues that Alaskans cited to us as being of real concern. For example, we were able to obtain some protection for cabin sites that are not memorialized in fee ownership, a protection for incidental uses relating to certain uses like hunting, as I indicated earlier, a guarantee of access by traditional means, and a number of other specific items that contribute at least to the Alaska lifestyle. The other element of the traditional lifestyle that occupied a lot of our attention was the impact on sport hunters, particularly on urban sport hunters. This is one of the areas of the bill that, as I'll indicate later, I think requires significant improvement. There are important areas in the Wrangells and Lake Clark and Katmai, in the McKinley extensions, where sport hunting has been a traditional Alaska occupation and where the existence of pure national parks would now preclude that activity. I don't view this as a conflict between urban sport hunters and subsistence users. The subsistence people in Washington were tacitly supportive of our efforts to convert pure parks where sport hunting is prohibited to park preserves or other management designations where sport hunting would be allowed. And we will continue that effort. The seventh consensus point relates to the exclusion of high-value commodity resources from the boundaries of restrictive conservation system units where development would otherwise be precluded. I think it's useful to divide that consensus point into at least four major activities in Alaska. The first is commercial fishing. The boundaries of the conservation system units all end at the mean high tide mark, so there should be no conflict with commercial fishing offshore. In those areas where commercial fishing exists now within the inland waterways or estuaries, we were able to obtain specific language which assures the continuation of those activities, and in a couple of instances even permits the continued use of shore-based facilities that are related to commercial fishing. The second activity concerns timber harvesting principally in Southeast, which became one of the most controversial issues in the bill. The bill, by the account of the timber industry, does preserve the existing job base in Southeast, which was our goal. That is, it assures an annual allowable cut of 450 million board feet. It accomplishes that through a system of land designations plus a guaranteed allocation of funds from Congress. The land designations in the bill were too expansive to ensure the continuation of existing jobs without some other sort of remedial congressional action. The bill does accomplish a good deal of what the conservationists wanted in Admiralty Island and Misty Fjords and a number of smaller wilderness areas, and it was our feeling that all of those wilderness designations together would have significantly jeopardized the job base in Southeast. Therefore, Congress included a provision in the bill that allocates $40 million on a mandatory basis each year for intensive silviculture in marginal timber areas that might not otherwise be harvested. That $40 million occurs not through the normal appropriation process, but through access to a fund of proceeds derived from activities on federal lands, and so we're actually assured that that money will be made available. I think that it is true to say that the job situation, that jobs will not grow as quickly as they might have on federal lands in Southeast, but hopefully that situation will be somewhat ameliorated by the activities that will occur on state lands and on private lands, principally native lands. The next major industry affected by the bill is the oil and gas industry, and that there are three principal components, I think, to look at. The bill does provide an assessment of the Arctic National Wildlife Range. The assessment would start with about 18 months of biological baseline research, followed by the remaining time spent on seismic activity. Only Congress could authorize either drilling for development purposes or for production. So, while I think this study is useful, it probably will not yield the kind of really definitive information that ultimately we will have. And I think that this particular area probably is more important in the commodity resource situation than any other in the bill, because there is, by USGS estimates, a 1% probability of 32 billion barrels of oil in a 1.3 million acre area of the Arctic coastal plain. The only way that that we'll ever be able to assess that probability, which is based on computer modeling, is through seismic work and perhaps drilling. The second key area is the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. That area was not treated in the D2 bill at all, but it was treated in collateral legislation that was enacted at the same time, and that is the Interior and Related Agencies Appropriation Bill. There's a rider in that bill, which, as many of you probably know, mandates two lease sales within 20 months, and there is an exemption from the requirements of NEPA, provided that those sales total less than 2 million acres. In addition, the bill provides a 50-50 revenue sharing split with the state of Alaska. The third major component of the oil and gas situation relates to oil and gas leasing on non-North Slope federal lands. And there, the Secretary is mandated to start a program of exploration and leasing. And one significant improvement that we felt existed was that in the future, the burden of proof will change. No longer will an applicant be faced with years of inaction and no clear understanding of why his application was disapproved. Because in this situation, the Secretary must actually state the reasons for his disapproval within a finite period. The last major industry, I think, impacted by the bill is hard rock minerals. And I think here the impact is greater than it is on the other commodity industries that I've just mentioned. We were able to protect the operating rights of the seven so-called world-class mines identified by the Stanford Research Institute. Those are mines like Borax, Greens Creek, et cetera. Sometimes the operating restrictions are fairly stringent, but all of the companies with whom we spoke felt that the situation was sufficiently flexible to permit them to proceed in an orderly way. I think then that the principal impact of the bill is on future opportunities, because there's no question that there are some very high-value hard rock mineral areas within the boundaries of the park and even to some extent the refuge units. To some extent, those impacts can be ameliorated by sympathetic policies, if that's what is chosen, on state lands, and of course some native corporations have expressed an interest in oil and gas leasing. Beyond that, the bill does repeal the wilderness review provisions of the BLM Organic Act. So I think that will create an easier situation on the BLM lands outside of the conservation system units for exploration and development. As I'll indicate a little later, though, this is another one of the areas where we want to propose specific amendments to try and improve the situation. The last industry worth mentioning, at least in passing, is tourism. And I think without question, the bill, even with the more expansive boundaries that we opposed, will promote tourism and hopefully tend to ameliorate some of the other impacts. The next thing that I'd like to talk about very briefly is the implementation process. I believe that the implementation process is at least as important, or perhaps even more important, than the development of the bill was originally. There are a number of places in the bill where the Secretary has discretion and can legally act in a number of different ways. Moreover, there are clearly ambiguities in the bill that we were not able to resolve. In those instances, a sympathetic national administration can do much to soften the impacts that have concerned us. And I think that the philosophy of this new administration will reflect that kind of empathy with the Western states that we were looking for earlier and could not find. It's my view that the problem will not be so much with philosophy, but competition for scarce federal dollars and manpower to accomplish some of the things that we're hoping for. The first thing I ought to mention, I guess, is that we have just about completed the transition from the advocacy function that I've been responsible for to implementation by line agencies of state government. I have neither the staff, organization, or the personal interest to be involved in the bureaucratic aspects of implementation, and I think that those aspects, to the extent that the state chooses to participate, are much more appropriately suited to line agencies of government that have the technical expertise to participate one-on-one with the federal government. Our real goal in this implementation process is really to protect state interests and the interests of individual Alaskans, particularly Alaskans who really don't have the resources to deal with the federal government in situations where their interests might be affected. And so I know that there are some who argue not a cent for D2 tribute in terms of funding any state activities related to implementation, but I respectfully urge all of you to look at that, because I think really, in a sense, if we're not careful, we could cut off our nose to spite our faces. We need at least a modest amount of money to ensure that state interests are protected, I think. The first major element of implementation that we're looking at is amendments to the bill. We've identified two specific areas of concern so far, and I think others will materialize in the implementation process. The first area is amendments to alleviate impacts on urban sport hunters by converting park areas to park preserve. A park preserve is a park except that sport hunting would be allowed. We're looking now at areas in the Wrangells and Lake Clark, in the McKinley extensions, in the central part of the Gates, which have been heavily hunted by urban sport hunters before. And we will be presenting our findings to the congressional delegation. It is really their decision about how to proceed, but every contact we've had with them has been very sympathetic, and they've analyzed the bill in the same respects, really, that we have. We're looking at a couple of different major options for how to proceed in that area. And we've consulted as much as we can with groups up here. The second major amendment that we're looking at relates to strategic and critical minerals. It's our judgment that within the next 5 to 10 years there will be a strategic and critical minerals crisis in the country, at least as serious as the current energy crisis. And we have found, working with the Alaska Miners Association and others, that it is possible to identify areas that could be excised from conservation system units without causing really serious environmental impacts. These are high-value areas for strategic and critical minerals, and again, we hope to be presenting our findings to the congressional delegation very soon. The third series of amendments will be suggested by the early implementation of the bill, perhaps amendments, for example, with respect to the transportation title, where some glitches undoubtedly exist. The fourth amendment that I think that we can all look for will come from the oil and gas industry and may expedite the oil and gas study process for the Arctic National Wildlife Range that I mentioned earlier. The next major challenge confronting the state deals with those activities which we must begin immediately in order to take cognizance of rather severe time frames in the bill. The first such activity is relates to the so-called interim regulations for the management of conservation system units. They've just recently been published and are being distributed throughout Alaska. We were able to make conceptual input into those regulations, but because of applicable legal restrictions on the Interior Department, we were not permitted to see successive drafts of the regulations. In essence, they were going to promulgate them originally as emergency rules and felt that we could not therefore participate directly in the process. We were able to resolve, even at that early level, several significant problems. There still are undoubtedly other problems, and we are just beginning to look at those, and of course we'll be making a detailed input to the Interior Department. Other activities that will occur in a relatively short time frame have been described in two memoranda, which hopefully have been sent to you. I asked the D2 Information Office to do that. One is a memorandum prepared by the Attorney General's Office that details state responsibilities under the bill, and one is a memorandum prepared by the Interior Department that details federal responsibilities. Other near-term responsibilities that are of significant importance to the state are, for example, analyzing pending native allotments to ascertain whether they must be objected to pursuant to criteria that exist in the bill, and looking at the early phases of the Bristol Bay Cooperative Study. The next major item that would be of interest to you is the bureaucratic structure that we have devised for dealing with implementation of D2. That can be divided, I think, into three or four major components. The first concerns what we do in the District of Columbia to advocate state interests in the Congress and in the executive branch. The governor has determined to turn that office into a general advocacy function for the state of Alaska. It will be manned probably by me, at least on an interim basis, and it's our intention to advocate state interests not only relating to D2, but to all other concerns that the state has in Washington, and we hope there to work on a cooperative basis with the legislative office that was created last year. In addition, the governor has made the decision to rehire the firm of Bill Timmons and Company, which worked with us on the Alaska lands issue. I think, frankly, is one of the best lobby firms that I've ever seen in action. And with the ascendancy of President Reagan, we'll have, I think, a significant input into decision-making in the Reagan administration and in the Senate. The second aspect of the implementation process concerns the Federal State Council, which is created in the bill. We view that as an opportunity for the state to present its views and have them heard by the federal government and to sort of be a watchdog of federal action, because it is likely that federal state council will not begin to operate for several months because of fiscal year funding limitations. We have just restructured what's called the Alaska Land Managers Task Force, and that group would mirror to the extent that it can in the absence of legislation the functions and composition of the ultimate land use council, and could be a focus for some very constructive discussion about state concerns and also federal concerns as well. The next element relates to the governor's office itself. The governor believes that the state must have a very visible and active role in protecting state interests, and toward that end, he's asked his executive assistant, Jerry Reinwan, to, in essence, be the D2 overseer. Jerry will have as staff access really to any agencies of state government, and in particular will rely on the Division of Policy Development and Planning to help coordinate state agency responses. And then all of us who, the veterans of the last D2 war, hopefully will be around to help Jerry in what I think is a very important job. The last element worth mentioning is what the federal government is doing with respect to restructuring its decision-making process. It appears now that the Secretary sees a need, as we do, to sort of centralize D2 decision-making and to keep a handle on it himself. And we've been very encouraged that Bill Horn, a very able fellow from Congressman Don Young's office, will probably perform those functions for the Secretary, among others. His specific job title has not yet been determined, but it's clear that he will be the funnel to the Secretary on most of the major implementation decisions. The next major component of implementation concerns the information effort inside Alaska and perhaps outside. Inside Alaska, there is a tremendous need to disseminate information about the bill in the form of the bill and maps and summaries of the bill. That is, we view as principally a federal responsibility, and we will do everything we can to encourage them to acknowledge that responsibility. But there are some state functions as well, because we can help Alaskans to understand what's in the bill, how the bill impacts them, and what their remedies are in the face of adverse impacts. We are taking cognizance now of the legislature's directive to close down D2 operations and return the remaining D2 money to the legislature, which is a promise that we made. We feel that the efforts of the D2 Information Office are genuinely related to winding down the D2 effort as they distribute the information about the bill. But because of the continuing need, the governor will fund their efforts out of his contingency fund for a period of time, and some funds may be requested in a supplemental request to the legislature. We can't see a need now to continue their operations beyond June 30th, but at least up until June 30th, from the experience we've had so far, there seems to be a need. The second element concerns anything that the governor and the legislature elect to do with respect to information outside of Alaska. Here, we're not talking so much about information specifically related to D2. I think that except for perhaps some work on specific amendments, that's not so much the issue. But I do see a need, just from having spent so much time outside the last couple of years, for the state to at least think about ways that it can improve, quote-unquote, its image in the lower 48. As a product of the D2 debates, which have really occurred over a 10-year period and not just over the last 2 years, certain interests have found it to their best interest, I think, to denigrate the state and what it stands for. And I think that we perhaps ought to think about ways we can improve that image to show people that we are not the blue-eyed Arabs of the North or the poor conservationists that we are sometimes portrayed to be. And I know that the governor is studying that issue and will have some proposals to make to the legislature on some of his findings. And I do think it's worth mentioning, and probably should have mentioned it before, that at least on D2, we're not out of the woods yet, at least in terms of some national environmental groups, which have already announced their intention to try to and obtain in this Congress what they were unable to obtain in the last Congress. And while I think they're in a more defensive mode than they were before, we at least have to be prepared to deal with that. I think some of the initial focus may occur in Southeast. The next major issue is state budget requirements. The governor, about a month ago, asked all state agencies to examine the budget implications of D2 legislation and to report back to him. Those reports are now all in, and within the next week or two, the Budget Review Committee will be meeting for the purpose of synthesizing and analyzing that input so that we can make a budget request to the legislature. It's our intention to make that as bare bones as possible, and really to look at those items of D2 implementation which are related to protecting state interests. I'll end there because I have not seen the specific budget requests of the agencies. Another element of budgetary review, though, that we're going to take very seriously is the federal budget process. There are certain states like California that have been extremely active in promoting their interest in the federal budget process, beginning in the federal executive branch and carrying their activities forward into the Congress. And we think that there is some real value to the state in beginning to participate actively in that process. For example, the BLM land conveyance program that I mentioned to you earlier is very much contingent upon our capacity to get the money that is needed for the BLM to carry out those functions. And we're already beginning to look at the President Carter's budget submissions for the purpose of analyzing their impacts. The next major item of implementation, and mercifully there are only a couple more here, relates to our litigation against the federal government. The governor's made the decision that we do not want to drop that litigation. Undoubtedly, the bill has some significant impacts on the litigation. But we are now responding to Judge Vonderheit's request to restructure our complaint in the aftermath of the passage of the bill, and we've asked for a 30-day extension to accomplish that. So within the next 30 days or so, we will be filing that. We will maintain our basic counts with respect to the Antiquities Act, the BLM Organic Act withdrawals, and the state compact theory. On some counts, we may have to pursue all the way through to the end of the litigation process. On others, we're hopeful in a more favorable administration to be able to enter into some out-of-court settlements that may inure to our benefit in the future. The next issue relates to state legislation that may or may not be necessary to effectuate D2 purposes. Tom, and with specific emphasis on the subsistence title, Tom Meacham and I have looked at that issue very carefully, and for whatever it's worth, it is our judgment, and I will document this more specifically with respect to subsistence, that no state legislation is immediately necessary to implement the bill or to protect state interests. In a couple of instances, we're assuming that the legislature may want to express its will in the form of a fiscal note, or that the governor may want to issue an executive order. But we were sort of pleased to find that there are no imminent needs for state legislation. And if you so choose, that may put you in the posture of being able to observe the early phases of implementation and hopefully working cooperatively with us, figure out what that suggests. I want to mention the subsistence title in particular because it's been a subject of such great controversy recently. Here, I don't want to dwell, at least in this discussion, on the dialogue that's occurring with respect to the state law, but only talk about the interrelationship between federal law and state law. The federal law is not all-encompassing in the sense that it mandates a comprehensive state title on subsistence. It does deal with three specific areas that were of great concern to the Congress. The first of those is the definition of subsistence, and there is a definition of subsistence in the bill. There was never a realistic possibility of eliminating the federal subsistence title from the bill. It has a history that goes back 10 years. We chose, therefore, to concentrate our efforts on ensuring that to the maximum extent possible, the federal law respected and reflected state law and policy. And at least the version that was ultimately enacted into law, I think did a pretty good job of that. So that the definition of subsistence use is not very different from the definition that already exists in state law. The second federal preoccupation was with a stated preference for subsistence over other consumptive uses when the resource is in jeopardy. And again, here the statute and the legislative history reflect the state's approach to that problem as it exists now. And we were able to actually incorporate in the legislative history some of the Board of Fish and Game policy. The third federal concern was with an administrative structure that ensured meaningful local and regional input into the decision-making process. There was no requirement that these local and regional boards have rulemaking authority, but only that they have advisory authority. It's our judgment, when I say ours, I think Tom Meacham and mine, and we've discussed it with several other lawyers on both sides,
that the state is roughly in compliance right now with the federal law. And therefore, it's been our suggestion that we not proceed too quickly, at least looking only at the federal requirements. Now, there may be some needs that are generated by our experience in implementing the state law that should be kept separate. But there are some early warning networks, mechanisms in the federal law that will tell us if people think that we are not in compliance. One of those is a federal monitoring function where the secretary is required to issue a report after a year of observing implementation. Another is the so-called judicial enforcement section, which permits private parties, really following the prototype of the common law, to initiate litigation after they've exhausted their administrative remedies with the state or with the federal government in the case of federal responsibilities. We think that that gives the state some response time using its administrative remedies to perceive whether, in fact, it wants to deal with a particular problem of action. There may also be some need to look at monetary requirements and staffing for the regional councils, and I know that the Department of Fish and Game is doing that. So at least for the present, we don't necessarily see the demand that some people have alluded to. The last thing worth mentioning is that, and it's a mundane thing, but it's important, we want to compile a comprehensive legislative history of the bill from day one till the end, which would be available for use by our people as they confront the federal government on specific issues, and also by Alaskans who are trying to research their own problems. And we've entered into a contract now with a firm in Washington that will enable us to have that sort of legislative history in the not-too-distant future. Madam Chairman, I think with that, I should stop and see what questions might exist.
Senator Sturgis,
questions now or later?
I think he's called for them now, so let's go
Madam
right
Chairman,
ahead.
Madam Chairman, John, brilliant overview.
Thank you.
Question on the issue of subsistence. It's become a very hot kind of local issue apart from what's happening. You're recommending no changes. What about the possibility of changes on the state level? Can you see to perhaps respond to some of the questions that have been raised as to how the state is enforcing, are getting into some real problems with, we have to be very cognizant of what's happened on the federal level when we start making changes.
Well, the federal statute requires that there be laws of general applicability that deal with those three specific items that I referred to earlier. And laws of general applicability, as Tom and I have been discussing, is a term of art that can include regulations of general applicability aside from statutory law. So in my view, and Tom can speak for himself, I think it is theoretically possible for the state to be in compliance with the federal requirements even if there wasn't statutory law on all of those items, provided that the regulations and the policy reflected those three federal preoccupations. It clearly would not be as easy to accomplish in some respects, but it's, I think, at least possible. And I've also looked at the state initiative from that point of view and discussed that with some of the proponents of the initiative. From purely a legal point of view, the initiative might create some additional problems that I honestly don't believe the proponents intended. As I understand it from talking to them, they intended to permit the boards to go back to the status quo that existed the day before the subsistence law, state subsistence law. And at least my feeling is that that status quo could have, perhaps with certain administrative adjustments, met the federal requirement. But there may be some prohibitions in the initiative that would create problems that that would require a federal response. For example, the current initiative precludes distinctions based on local residency. And that is one of the processes in the federal law. And so even though the board was using seasons and bag limits to accomplish certain concerns with local residency, it might well be that a court would pierce those seasons and bag limits and look at the true purpose. And the proponents of the initiative are looking at that issue now because we just met last week.
Thank you.
Do you have anything?
John, in that line, you did say that we were roughly in compliance, but with the December deadline, could that, if then that roughly is comes out to be really rough, could that then necessitate a special session if something is not done?
My own view is not. When I say roughly in compliance, I probably should have been more precise than that, because I think that we are in compliance with respect to the definition of subsistence and the statement of the subsistence priority that exists in state law. Where there may be some problems, and this is my own personal view, is in the administrative structure, but I don't view those as statutory problems so much as making sure that the local and regional structure can meaningfully accomplish what the federal government wanted. And I think that we ought to have some advance warning, if I'm not correct, that from the federal government that in fact there are significant problems that they perceive that we don't. And I share your concern, though. The net effect of our being wrong on this is that the federal government creates its own administrative structure and then begins to manage the resource. And,
well, that was my fear, and you say there should be some indications. I'm concerned, of course, with the time frame, because as in Washington, we move very quickly here, and June, July, October, November, whenever it happens to be, or May or March, it could still be a problem.
We've already started discussions with the federal government to ascertain what their views are on the implementation process. I think that the regulations, the interim regulations, are sort of neutral on that issue. But I have the feeling now that particularly in this new administration that a dialogue exists so that we would know quickly, aside from those early warning mechanisms that are already in the statute.
And you would let us know quickly if you saw some of those early warning signals?
Absolutely. And I hope, too, and I'm sure that other people will look at the current situation to see if they share the conclusions that Tom and I have come to. But I did try to canvass a lot of the lawyers and others who were involved in the process of putting that title together, and I think with maybe one or two exceptions, I'm reflecting a fair consensus of what their thinking is.
Mr. Fisher?
John Arliss, I'm very grateful for the good overview, because this has been one of the frustrations, to really not seeing the total picture. In follow-up to the questions and comments that we just had, what would be the effect on subsistence, on Alaska, if the federal government found the state not to be in compliance with respect to subsistence?
I think that the effect would be terribly deleterious, because the federal regime and the management regime would then apply to all federal lands and the waters within those lands. And I think that would inure, first of all, to the significant detriment of the resource, because there would be at least the potential for conflicting management regimes on the federal lands on one hand and on state and private lands on the other. And beyond that, I think it would subject subsistence users to a very confusing and conflicting approach to management, so that they would really never know what the ground rules were.
Does this mean that the federal government would move in and exercise jurisdiction over fish and game resources on all federal lands and waters within those lands?
Yes, sir. I think that's what it means. The first step would be the creation of the administrative structure of local and regional boards that would then not address the state, but would be responsible for making advice, giving advice to the secretary. And I think that while the bill doesn't expressly detail exactly what follows all the way through from there, that it's very clear, the implication is very clear, that the federal government would actually manage the resource, set its own seasons and bag limits, etc.
That would certainly be a very serious effect.
So, do you agree with that, Tom?
Yes, Senator Fisher. I think one of the problems we have with the subsistence title, the mechanism of it, is it doesn't give us a specific indication of when the secretary is going to make a determination whether the state is in compliance or isn't in compliance. It merely says that within 1 year, if the state does certain things or has laws of certain general applicability, then the secretary will not undertake his own system. So we will need to know, and I would hope hopefully before the legislative session is out, whether there are any serious problems with the statutes and regulations we now have. And of course, if the legislature changes existing state law sometime during this session in a manner which would make it practically impossible to undertake the state participation in the program. That would probably be done with a conscious result in mind, which would mean that the secretary at the end of that one-year period would probably be required to undertake management.
What happens if a secretary finds the state to be in compliance at the end of 1 year, and then next year, let's say the legislature or the people by initiative process repeal the subsistence law, or somehow we get out of compliance? Does the secretary then still have the authority to move in and take away state jurisdiction over federal land?
He does. There's no specific process in the bill, but I think the implication is very clear that if at the end of the second year he finds that we are not in compliance, that then those very same mechanisms could become operative. I think, too, Madam Chairman, in response to your query before, we ought to address and will address a very specific inquiry of the Secretary even now to see if they have any views about whether the state is in compliance in the present situation, so we can begin to get some preliminary indication of that.
Have you discussed with any of the federal legal people if they're of the same opinion that you are? Is this?
We have, in the context of these so-called conceptual discussions of the interim regulations, and I can't bind them to any particular conclusion, but I had the very clear feeling from the discussions we had, and these were mainly with people in the solicitor's office, that they viewed us as being in compliance now, with the exception of needing one more regional council, which could be accomplished by executive action, and at least looking at whether the councils were really operating as Congress intended.
Of course, it's a very hot item, and there have been those that have suggested, and of course, pending initiative, that we should do away with the subsistence law and go back to what we had. And I thought I caught, John, in some of your remarks, you're saying that possibly back in the days when fish bag limits pre-subsistence, that they might in fact have qualified, although some questions might have been. Do you feel that if the state were to change how they approach subsistence, go back, if you will, or do away with that law, that we would engender immediate action by the federal government? What reaction would our change, say, going back to another method have as far as the federal government?
I don't think that, and this is my own personal view again, I don't think that, and I'm not expressing a view on the merits of it, but just the law, I don't think that a repeal of the state statute in and of itself should trigger the federal concern. Now, only they can speak about whether it will. Because a repeal would nevertheless, in the absence of anything else, permit the boards of fish and game to manage the resource pursuant to a de facto definition of subsistence and a priority for subsistence, et cetera. And in fact, in a number of key instances, they did precisely that before there was a state law, and in fact developed a good administrative policy that we incorporated partly in statutory language and got in the bill. So I'm not alleging, though, that the federal government won't be really concerned about a repeal, but I my own view is we could continue. The real thing I'd want to look at, though, is if there was any preclusion on the boards, prohibition on the boards of managing in reference to some of these federally stated criteria, which are also now in the current state law, like local residency or customary dependency on the resource or availability of alternative sources.
Senator Gilman.
Mr. Katz, you mentioned when you were talking in the section on the National Petroleum Reserve, the 50-50 revenue split with the state. Isn't that substantially different than what we have on other federal lands?
It is substantially different than the 90-10 split that applies on public lands. But NPRA was really always in a legal vacuum because there was the 90-10 formula did not apply by its terms to NPRA, and therefore
we felt that we would have to fight that battle when there was enabling legislation for NPRAs. As I'm sure you know, there have been some comprehensive bills that dealt with that. So I think it is probably more accurate to say that in the absence of congressional action, we would probably not have been entitled to anything. And the 50-50 thing is improvement on that. We, of course, argued, as did the congressional delegation, for 90-10, but unfortunately the debate on that issue came up almost simultaneously with the news about our tax repeal and some other things, and we just didn't get a very sympathetic response.
John, do you see that affecting the 9-10 relationship in any other areas?
I do, and I think that's one of the reasons why, at least I think we ought to give some consideration to the 90-10 or the reaction of Congress to the...
Specifically the 90-10, but I'm very happy to have you bring out the reaction of Congress because I've been very concerned about that.
Well, I have on both fronts, too. I think that the Congress needs some additional education, and perhaps that it can't be accomplished, in my view, only with a lobby effort. In my view, our lobby effort over time really prevailed against the environmentalists, but when we lost, we tended to lose because of the grassroots support that they were able to generate. And I think there is a lot of misapprehension in various states among the people about what Alaska's true situation is. And in some way, it's not grandiose and not too expensive. I would like to sort of address that by showing people, you know, the problems that we really do confront. I see that general demeanor, though, as reflecting itself in a number of specific concerns. I'm not positive about the 90-10 formula. We have survived most of the statutes which would seek to change that in some respect or another. For example, the BLM Organic Act in 1976 was an opportunity for change, and the congressional delegation resisted that. One specific place that we may see the change attempted is in wildlife refuges, which could have a tremendous impact in terms of the Arctic National Wildlife Range. For years, certain congressmen, irrespective of D2, have proposed legislation that would reduce the 90-10 formula and would approximate the 75-25 formula that applies to certain other refuge receipts. Under that formula, the federal government gets 75% and the local municipalities get 25%. That, as you probably know, is now the subject of litigation involving the Kenai Moose Range and the Swanson River oil field, and is currently pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. Congressman Dingell, in particular, has sought to look at that revenue-sharing formula. I suspect, though, that the state needs to be prepared, and it's one of the reasons why we rehired Timmons and Company for a general onslaught on our revenue-sharing formulas and our special appropriations.
If no other member of the committee has questions just now, I'd like to ask you, with the President putting the freeze on all federal regulations, will that have any impact on the ability for us to use motorized vehicles or anything within any of our federal lands or park systems?
There is a gray area that's occurring now, but I think that the federal reaction is going to be pretty sympathetic. And in fact, one of the principal purposes of these interim regulations was to make it clear that certain regulations of general applicability in the lower 48 did not apply in Alaska. Those regulations would have precluded motorized vehicle use and a number of other activities. But it's our view that the bill prevails and the statutory language very clearly allows it. And even if there are no implementing regulations, those activities ought to be permitted until regulations can specifically memorialize them. I think that's the federal government's response. Beyond that, the 60-day freeze, at least our early indication, doesn't affect these regs all that much because the public input phase, which is the first 45 days, will occur anyway, and it's highly unlikely that the federal government would have finalized those regulations within the second 15 days. So in terms of the final efficacy of regulations, unless President Reagan chooses to extend that time frame, I'm not sure there'll be much effect.
Thank you, John. Senator Lyons.
Johnny, you mentioned a $40 million figure relates to harvesting of timber. Does that pertain to the Tongass National Forest? And would you elaborate on how they're using this money?
Yes, I'm not an expert, I'm the first to admit, on Southeast, but Generally, that formula is derived from revenues from federal lands that occur by means of oil and gas lease sales, the disposition of other commodity resources on the federal lands. And it's my understanding that there is an excess of $1 billion in that fund right now, and this $40 million is skimmed off the top. So some of the problems that we foresaw in the appropriation process will probably not occur in this allocation process. Those funds will then be used principally in the Tongass, in marginal areas, to permit the timber harvesting of areas that probably would not have occurred if the Forest Service was just following its normal land management plans. And our early indications are that the environmentalists do not look favorably on those provisions, because I think one of the reasons being that they don't necessarily want to see harvesting in some of those marginal areas.
I finish it, Senator Larson. Senator Zalewski, did you have another question? Any other members have a question? Senator Fisher.
John, you mentioned in the beginning that the Act confirmed state selections over 98 million acres and sort of made a general reference to the state having certain authorities in those specifically. Or as specifically as you can, what extent of state jurisdiction will there be pending BLM adjudication of those?
Those areas will continue to be managed by the federal government. And as I recall, the federal government will continue, as we think at least, to be responsible for fire control. I have felt, though, that in limited situations, and I've not confirmed this with title companies or others, that the state, if it contemplates some immediate activity and doesn't want to wait, even though we have all right title and interest, but doesn't want to wait for marketable title through the adjudication process, we might be able to approximate the adjudication process on some limited amount of land. And I think the real, you know, the test of whether that's possible or not will be what banks and title companies, how they react to that. If they're willing to accept that as being tantamount to the Interior Department process, then we might be able to forge ahead. But I think, by and large, although right title and interest is passed to the state, they will be managed as if they were state-selected lands in the current situation.
Which may be equivalent to TA'd lands so that the state could issue oil leases.
My view is, and Tom has some views too, that they would be less considered to be less in terms of secure land tenure than TA, because TA really does reflect the BLM adjudication process, subject only to survey and the issuance of final patent. So all the third-party interests have been determined, and that will not have been the case with respect to these legislatively conveyed lands.
In other words, the state would not be in a position to dispose of mineral rights or timber or open land for agriculture.
I don't think so, unless it were able to approximate the adjudication process and assure people that that title was marketable.
How much does BLM need to implement transfer of the land to the state? You mentioned that that's one of the issues, but how much money is involved in any way the state might push harder to get the money, or maybe even funds for that?
I've given a little thought to your last question, too. I don't know how the federal government would view that, whether there'd be any conflict of interest in using state monies for that federal responsibility. We're trying right now to get a really good handle on the BLM budget. We've gotten, at our request, some budget data from them now. And it's clear from looking at that data that the Office of Management and Budget cut back significantly on what the Interior Department requested, and that the Interior Department, therefore, is not going to be able to meet even the goals that Secretary Andrus stated, which I think was 13 million acres a year. But I don't know how much less than that the new figures would result in, and that's what we're going to look at. Once we've done that, it would be our intention, I think, to try and prevail on the Congress and the executive branch to increase those figures. You know, certainly that's an uncomplied, a federal promise made 20 years ago that still hasn't been complied with.
Are you going to pursue the question of whether the state might be able to
I certainly will, as a product of this discussion. I think it's at least an idea that we ought to look at.
I think it'd be real valuable for you.
John, we have the time limitations, et cetera, in the memorandum that you spoke of. What happens if we know kind of what happens if we don't meet our time limitations? What happens if the state doesn't, the feds don't meet their time limitations?
I guess it depends on the specific requirement, but there are a number of possible options. One is the federal oversight hearings that, thanks to Senator Murkowski's position and Senator Stevens, we would be in a position to help generate. In certain instances, we could look to a mandamus action going to court and actually requiring them to do something that was necessary, that the bill had mandated within a time frame. I think in some instances, at least in this new administration, you know, we can prevail upon them to act more quickly than they might otherwise want to. It is a significant problem, and a lot of things have been lost between the cup and the lip in the last 4 or 5 years with respect to other federal laws in Alaska.
Any other member of the committee have questions?
I understand there are all sorts of requirements in the Act for state agencies to come up with plans for managing this and a plan for that. Could you mention what has to be done?
Yeah, I wouldn't call them so much requirements in the sense that the federal government in these areas cannot legally mandate the state to do something, but there are certainly a number of opportunities. I'd say that there are at least two or three categories in reference to your question. One is where the state is specifically mentioned as the implementing agency if it so chooses, for example, the subsistence title. The second is where the state would participate by statute if it chooses with the federal government, although the federal government has the lead role. Two examples of that, for example, would be the Chugach Land Study, and secondly would be the Bristol Bay Cooperative Study. And the third area is an area where the state is not specifically mentioned either as a function that the feds would like us to perform or that we could cooperatively work on, but where we see it in our own self-interest to be involved with the federal government, whether they like it or not. And Kathy Boggs' memo that the chairman was referring to earlier, I think, tries to deal with all three of those kinds of responsibilities. And also, when the governor made his budget request to state agencies, he did it with those three kinds of responsibilities in mind.
John, we are very happy to have you, and I know we didn't particularly make use of you're so interesting that we just kind of sidetracked. We seem to think we can get too much easier to ask questions, but we very much appreciate your being here today. We will try to keep in close contact as we go through the session with listening for advice and asking you answers to some of our questions.
Thank you. And no one should hesitate to give me a call or if I'm between one place and another, which has been all too true in the last couple of years, Jerry Reinwand is a good focal point. I understand, too, Madam Chairman, that the President of the Senate has reappointed the D2 Oversight Group, and probably we ought to see what sort of interrelationship you feel comfortable with that group.
Thanks a lot.
One further question. John, do you think, of course you understand the issue we've had in Admiralty Island for the last number of years. Is that resolved, or are we looking forward to some more problems?
Admiralty Island, sir?
Right.
I think...
Does that matter lead to rest?
I think that one's pretty well laid to rest. We've resolved, I think, the Greens Creek situation and the status of lands on the Mansfield Peninsula. One of the concessions that we were forced to make was a much larger wilderness designation on Admiralty than we had hoped for, so that should resolve some of those problems. Shiatica, which is the Sitka Corporation, now has vested rights on the island, which resolves their problem. And I guess the Kootenai situation is more in a state of flux in that they're going to be looking around for a land base to resolve their problem. Jim, do you have any comment on that? Yeah, I would say that of those four components, the Angoon situation is probably the most tenuous, but I think the others will pretty much remain intact.
Other questions? Then, with our thanks to you, committee's